Mount Hood is the tallest mountain in Oregon by a lot. At 11,250 feet, it's not Shasta-sized, but certainly big enough to create its own weather and give mountain climbers fits, and worse. Back in 1986, a climb of students and teachers from Oregon Episcopal School went up Mount Hood, and the weather turned ugly. In the end, two teachers and seven students died. It's a vivid memory for people living in Oregon at the time. Paul Stutonghi found out how vivid when he set out to write about the incident anew for an article in Outside magazine called Mount Hood's Deadliest Disaster. It was published just a few days ago. Paul Stutonghi has had work published in The New Yorker and Granta, among other publications. He teaches at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate having you here.
Oh, thank you very much.
So the fact that you live in Oregon explains the interest in the story, but this goes a bit deeper for your family and a bit closer to home, it sounds like.
Yeah, we. So my two children attend Oregon Episcopal School. They are twins, and they're in the third grade now, and they are they're very happy there. They have had a really wonderful experience with teachers and administrators, and so it's been a very positive experience overall for my kids. Part of the curriculum that I experienced as a dad involves the climb and the commemoration of the climb in the present day at the school. And so starting in first grade, well, starting in kindergarten, students perform service on Mount Hood Climb Service Day. And starting in first grade, they are told the story of the climb in chapel. And so that was very powerful to hear, and also, to watch the impact that had on my children, especially my son.
So every year they basically commemorate the anniversary of the disaster by having a service day?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because you don't sort of have to commemorate something like this with service. It's not a natural fit necessarily, but I think that the way that I understand it is that the Portland community and the Oregon community and even beyond that, really all across the country, there was such an outpouring of support for the school, by and large, and for the parents who had suffered so much. And the school decided to commemorate that service that the community did for the school by then in turn giving back to the community through service on this one really organized day. It's a deep principle in the curriculum, is trying to organize the school around that service. So as far as I know, as far as I've experienced it as a parent, that is.
Big Dave's, so. Okay. So, but in terms of understanding what happened in May of 1986, what were you not getting from earlier accounts of the trip that you wanted to know? What propelled you further into wanting to research and write the story?
Well, the thing for me that sort of tipped the balance for deciding to try and answer this question of what it was that happened was that I didn't know. And this is a very complicated story. It is a tragedy that had a lot of twists and turns and different moments of inflection. And I just as a person who wants to know more about things, I really decided that I wanted to sort of investigate it further. And so I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to write, but I went to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office to get the police report, which I've done in other cases that I've, stories that I've written about. And when I went to the Clackamas County Sheriff, they said to me, "Oh, it's a good thing you came in because we were about to destroy this file. And, we hadn't marked it for destruction. I mean, the file exists because there have been people who have requested it and gotten it over the years, but I mean, not a lot of people, and it's just sort of individually held in their libraries or archives or drawers or wherever they keep it. So, but the actual person or organization responsible for preserving it was about to destroy it. So, within weeks. So, it was really lucky, and I sort of thought to myself, well, if I wanted to know what happened on that climb, and I was an educator, an organizer, an outward bound organizer, working at an independent school, I would not have any first person written accounts whatsoever. There would be none. And this, the only one actually was the statement by Ralph Summers, who was the guide, and that was in that file. And it, so I felt like, well, this is something that's not preserved. And then anecdotally speaking with my friends, if you're 40 or under, it's not a very clear memory. I was 10 in 1986. I had not heard of it before my kids went to school at Oregon Episcopal School. And even after being there for a year, it took me a while to sort of understand the story.
All right. The story is told again in Mount Hood's Deadliest Disaster by our guest Paul Stotonghi in the current issue of Outside Magazine. It's online as well. You can join the conversation on the Exchange when we come back from this break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Portland educator and writer Paul Stotonghi, who has written a new piece for Outside Magazine, now online, called Mount Hood's Deadliest Disaster. And it is about the famous episode in May of 1986 where a group from Oregon Episcopal School went to go to the top of Mount Hood and never made it because the weather just turned ugly and uglier. And by the time everything was over, two teachers and seven students were dead. Two students had been in the snow cave with the students did survive. Several others had turned back before the weather got to its worst. And it's just been interesting reading the account again and experiencing this again for a lot of people. And you can join the conversation on the Exchange, perhaps with your own memories of May of 1986 and this particular incident. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, you were talking about being an outward bound educator. Do you mean yourself? Do you do this for Oregon Episcopal School?
No, I do not. What I do for Oregon Episcopal School is all volunteer work that's associated with being a parent. So I'm the room parent for my daughter's classroom and kind of organize, the sort of parent side of things a little bit. And I'm a basketball coach for first grade and second grade, and I was the kindergarten basketball coach.
Kindergarten basketball coach. Wow, they start young now.
Well, yeah, it was a lot of sort of just running in circles without a lot of order.
Right, yeah.
But that's primarily how I have been a part of the community. Yeah, I'm very much out in the outdoors, and that's one of the things about living in Oregon is the opportunity to go camping and to get out, into the mountains, and it's a powerful thing,
part of why
I love living out here.
So as well known as you are, then clearly in the Oregon Episcopal School community, OES asked you not to run the story. Why?
Well, I mean, I think that is it's a really complicated position for them because as a school, they have a really broad constituency. You've got parents from that time, and you have alumni who are active in the community from those years. It's a very small community. There were only 40 students in the 1986 graduating class, and there were less in the 1988 graduating class. So it's a very small community, and I think that what they were sort of doing was exercising an abundance of caution and thinking that they were concerned about the impact of the story on the folks who had experienced this trauma. And I completely understand that. That is not a shocking or surprising thing. I was conscious of it from the very beginning, and I tried to write something that was as respectful as it possibly could be and as conscious of this thing that is a fact, which is that these families went through an unimaginable and almost unendurable difficulty, something that did in fact split some of them apart. And I wanted to respect that and to remember that throughout the process of writing it. The piece itself is called The House of Mourning, which comes from a quote from Ecclesiastes where, you know, it says that the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. And to me, that was not only a fitting title for the article, but also something to remember as I was sort of going about the process of writing it, that, you know, these were very much families who were still within the house of mourning. And I wanted to be aware of that.
That come through loud and clear. And I want to be clear, too, that this was not a first-time thing. Oregon Episcopal School ran this springtime climb for the sophomore class for years, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they were hoping to instill a love of the outdoors. They were hoping to instill wilderness leadership. They were following the principles of Outward Bound, I don't know, not explicitly perhaps, but certainly implicitly, where the experience of caring for a fellow man in danger or preparing to care for a fellow man or woman in danger is a very powerful experience and really will orient the self more toward compassion. And I think that that's what they were hoping to instill, the values that they were hoping to instill through these very challenging outdoor experiences. Even though Hood looks like you could just walk up it, you know, to the top, when you get up to Hogsback, it is a challenging ascent. And so I think that the program was kind of designed to build leadership, to instill a broad sense of values, to bring students together around a difficult process, because, you know, 10 students forced to work together to overcome an obstacle, it bonds them really tightly together. So you know, there were so many values that underlay that program, and I think that this was just a almost unimaginable worst case scenario.
So Paul Stutongi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His piece, "The House of Mourning," talks about the deadliest disaster on Mount Hood in the spring of 1986. So by the numbers, Mount Hood has a bit of a body count, doesn't it? I mean, it's claimed a number of people over the years.
Yeah, over 120. OregonLive.com, the Oregonian, has this list of fatalities. And it is, as far as alpine peaks in the United States, it's the second deadliest. You have Mount Rainier and then Mount Hood. And the Mount Washington in New Hampshire has had close to that many deaths associated with it, but many of them are from exposure or just sort of camping, because it's a much smaller mountain, you know, 6,000 feet.
Right, yeah, but by Western standards, not very tall, but a big difference from top to bottom there for sure. Let's talk about what the preparations were and then what the conditions were. The preparations were in charge of what, Father Tom Goman? Was he the one in the lead position?
He was, and there were various parents who volunteered to help him. And then there were also personnel from the school who, in a limited sense, assisted him as well. And the students were trained. They had what was sort of a snow-intensive training. The equipment that they had, they got at the equipment room at the school, and then when they got to Timberline Lodge, they got ice axes and helmets. So they had a lot of equipment. Unfortunately, one of the problems was that because of the weather, which was really, in my mind, the thing that is most to blame for what happened. Because the weather was so extreme, they were not able to utilize some of the equipment that they brought because it was buried.
Right, and boy, one of the most chilling parts is the shovel blowing away in the wind when they've already constructed a snow cave, and that was one of the tools they really needed the most. How bad was the storm up there compared to some of the worst weather recorded on Mount Hood?
I think it's one of the worst. A rescuer told me that the winds at the top of the Palmer ski lift were 103 miles an hour. And so that's, if those winds are sustained, it's a Category 2 hurricane. So if you imagine a Category 2 hurricane force gale with blowing snow as well, you can kind of begin to imagine what it was like. The wind would be howling off the side of the mountain. You wouldn't be able to have a conversation with someone who was a matter of feet away from you. You'd have no visibility. You know, when you would put your foot forward, you wouldn't be able to judge where the ground was, especially if you're on a slope or going sideways across a slope or down a slope. You just wouldn't be able to see the ground where you're stepping. And so that can induce a very powerful sense of vertigo, especially because if the ground is unexpectedly close, then you get very disoriented very quickly. So those are tremendously dangerous conditions, and they came up very suddenly, extremely suddenly. The storm was forecast. I think it was worse than Father Tom expected, and it came much quicker, I think, than he expected.
All right, so there was a storm forecast. They decided to go up, and then the storm apparently came in quicker. So at that point, a decision had to be made to go ahead or turn back. And
right.
Was that decision made or not made a couple of times?
Right, and so that's sort of the question. And, you know, it's really difficult because I think that the natural human impulse in any situation like this is to assign blame. You know, that's what is so... It's almost a necessary thing to be able to focus blame toward someone or something. And it's almost like an organizing principle. It allows a space for grief and for anger. And it makes everything sort of more comprehensible, you know, to kind of sit in a space where there is no blame, that's an incredibly difficult thing. And so I think that, you know, after the climb, the school did an official inquest, funded an official inquest, where they got some hypothermia experts and climbing experts and interviewed everyone who had gone on the climb. And they tried to sort of figure out what had happened. They tried to answer that question in a private report. And I think that the report kind of was clear that there were various points at which Father Tom should have turned back. But, you know, if you talk with people who are on the climb, they have various different feelings about that. And And one of the things that is that has complicated this over the years is that in the immediate aftermath of the climb, there was this loss. There were a series of lawsuits, only one of which actually made it to trial, and one of which was dismissed, and one of which was settled. But that created this environment of just deep acrimony, and anger and accusation. And so, you know, this was an extremely difficult space in which to heal, you know, for all of the families. And it was just a very complicated time, I think. And so, you know, trying to figure out, did he turn back? Did he not? Should he have turned back? Should he have not turned back? It's like a natural impulse, but I don't know what it serves. You know, it doesn't serve. It serves our natural desire to have a story, a tidy story. But I think that there's something that's more important, which is sort of just kind of sitting with the fact that this thing happened and trying to understand, you know, the fact of it rather than anything else.
Paul Sutongi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The thing we're talking about is the May 1986 disaster on Mount Hood, in which an Oregon Episcopal school climb ran into bad weather and it ended up with two teachers and seven students dead. He recounts the story in a piece called The House of Mourning in the current issue of Outside Magazine. The piece is ready online. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange, perhaps with your own memories of the climb on Mount Hood in May 1986 and the sense of anxiety while we waited for news. I was living in Oregon at the time. I remember it very well. And then the sense of relief first, and then the sense of like, oh my God, what happened when it was all done? Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Where were the climbers? Were they well past the tree line when the weather turned to its worst?
Yeah, because the climb actually begins from timberline, which is right at the tree line at 6,000 feet. So you're almost immediately exposed to the elements. So you're you know, between 6,000 and 11,000 feet for the duration of the climb. It's a really high altitude, you know, and the wind is just unforgiving. And that's the elements are just unforgiving at that altitude. It's just it can be very surprising if it's your first time.
Now there were people who said, "I can't do this," and they turned back. I mean, how many of them split off and headed back for Timberline?
Yeah, so the entire party ended up as there were 20, and sort of one by one, folks peeled away, and we had there were almost within probably an hour or so, one student left. She, at the time in the police report, it says that she needed insulin. When I spoke with her, she said that she had developed a stomach ache and that she was not feeling well. And so she left. And then over the course of going up, the party reached Silcox Hut, and which is at 7,200 feet. And then right before that point, two more climbers left, and then two left from the hut. So I believe the total was seven that left of the 20. So,
and there was a moment in here, Paul's, when somebody was clearly having the effects of hypothermia. This is a fairly key moment, it seems like, in what transpired from that point.
Yes. So are you referring to which moment are you referring to exactly?
The when they stayed and got into a sleeping bag with the young man having
I thought that was a really, that was to me just an incredible thing. You know, and I don't want to I mean, this is part of the difficulty, is that I think that parents and brothers and sisters who lived through this time are now still with us, you know, and I'm conscious of the fact that when I'm talking in public about this, I could be speaking directly to someone who has lost a family member or a dear friend, almost invariably, you know, and...
And in fact, there's a point where you refer to the snow cave as a sanctified space, and I'll get into that in just the other side of a break. I do want to go there now. We're talking to Paul Stutonghi about his piece on the 1986 climbing disaster on Mount Hood, which killed two teachers and seven students from the Oregon Episcopal School. His piece in Outside magazine is called The House of Mourning. And you can obtain it right now online, but you can also listen to the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange as it plays out, and you can join that conversation by phone or email when we return from a break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are revisiting the May 1986 climbing disaster on Mount Hood in Oregon that killed two teachers and seven students from Oregon Episcopal School. Paul Stutonghi, who has children at Oregon Episcopal School, writes about it anew in a piece for Outside magazine called The House of Mourning. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Quite a few people in Oregon still remember this event, as do I. You mentioned Matt Zaffino, the meteorologist now at KGW. He was sitting next to me at the news desk in Medford when this story was unfolding. And so it's a little weird reading about this all over again. Obviously weird for you, too, as you were mentioning a moment ago. It sounds like you're more comfortable putting this in print than talking about it out loud.
Does it seem that way talking on the radio? You know, I think so. Maybe I was very careful with the article, and there's some element of it that is more fraught by talking about it in a public forum. But I think it's important to do that as well. I just think, you know, I think that we have to talk about the things that are the most important things in our life. If we do not talk about the things that are the most important things in our life, we suppress all kinds of things that end up being, I think, injurious to us, and it sort of makes it more difficult for us in the future to navigate through the invariable crises that, you know, life will offer us. That's my feeling anyway, and I think that in reporting the story, I went to this place called the Dougie Center, which is a really wonderful resource here in Portland, and actually has grown to be similar places like it throughout the country and the world. And the Dougie Center is a resource for grieving families and for especially grieving children. And when you go to the center, the thing that you notice when you walk in the door is that it is a bright and open space. And there are photographs of loved ones all over the walls. So one of the most powerful things that I saw when I went there was this wall that was maybe 10, 15 feet long and floor to ceiling covered with snapshots of people who were lost, who had been fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters and children. And that in seeing those photographs in the context of all these other photographs, what you then think is, you know, yes, we all lose people who are dear to us. And the bringing this with us as we live our daily lives is perhaps not the worst thing. In our culture, we really, really don't want to think about death and dying. And we really don't want to especially think about death and dying around children. And so I think that it can be a very painful topic, and so I'm that's why I'm a little bit nervous and hesitant, and as I'm talking about it. But you know, I do feel like there is importance in this. You know, I also do recognize this argument, which is that this is not my story to tell. Mm-hmm. You know, in some sense, and I think that if I didn't acknowledge that and sort of admit that, then that would be wrong of me. I think that you know, I believe that I came to the story through my kids' curriculum and in the way that they sort of emotionally connected with the story. That was kind of my first experience of it. So I felt like that was stable footing for me.
Let me mention the names here, because we haven't mentioned them yet, but found dead on the way to the place where the snow cave was dug were Aaron O'Leary and Allison Litzenberger and Eric Sandvik. In and around the snow cave were Susan McClave, Patrick McGinnis, Tasha Amy, Richard Hayter, and teachers Marion Horwell and Tom Goman. And two students were still alive in the cave, Brinton Clark and Giles Thompson. They survived. Giles Thompson did lose his legs, though, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Giles did. And he came back for service day this year, and he came to the ceremony along with his brother. And it was really powerful to see them both there. It was the first time that Ross had been back, Giles Thompson's brother, Ross Thompson. And he's a musician. He's a classical guitarist. He's become a classical guitarist. And he has written music for his brother. He's written music inspired by some of the events that he's endured over the years, and he's sort of poured this all into his classical guitar. And so they both came back for service day, and it was very difficult for Ross, because he had a lot of anger. And you know, it's a huge credit to the Mount Hood Climb Remembrance Committee, which is, they're very active at the school and chaired by an alum from the class of 88, or no, I think 86 actually, and to the administration and to the chaplain especially, who has created this space where you know, people who feel like OES let them down, that this was there should have been more oversight, that there should have been more therapy, that there should have been more counseling or something, that something and more needed to be done, feel like they can express that and can come back and talk about that within the community. I think that's a really powerful thing, you know, because it leaves that open for you. You know, you are not an exile, even if you're angry. If you're angry at the school, if you're furious at something, you can come back, and there is a place here for you. And I think that that's the message that I got pretty clearly. You know, the other thing that I didn't expect was, you know, this is very private, which that wasn't perhaps as clearly broadcast to me as.
I mean, the idea that this is the closed, you know, in-house pain of OES and shouldn't go public.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I think that's exactly it. But, you know, for me, I think about, if you look at our news and you look at these images that you see of schools, of synagogues, of public spaces of all kinds being violated and destroyed by armed, you know, by angry, you know, shooters and you know, this sort of large-scale tragedy. I've talked with several of the students who say that every time they open the newspaper and they see a school shooting and they see the images from that school shooting of the grieving families, the police tape around the school, or even the police presence at the school, the sort of crush of journalists at a place like Parkland, it just brings them right back into that moment. And so they relive that trauma. And so it's there, and it's as real as the minute that they experienced it the first time. So to me, that what that says is, okay, this is a really important thing. We have to talk about how, you know, we have to publicly talk about what does a school do if they have a large-scale tragedy like this, because if it's something that's happening 10 times a year, or, you know, or that's a little bit of a exaggeration, although...
Not much of one, really.
Not much of one, actually, you know? So, I think it's a matter of scale. So anyway, it's something that seems really important, right? That you talk about it and you think about it in public, and you don't close down the discourse around it, because it has, even though it's hard, and I think we have to talk about these things. And maybe the more that you talk about them, maybe it will filter in to the community, and maybe there's some kind of hope in that, where you will, that this understanding that destroying a community like this is a terrible thing to do will reach out really far into the culture, and maybe just enough that it can get to the very margins of those, you know, very disaffected people who do these acts. And who knows if, you know, so I feel like there has to be some kind of hope around that and talking. I don't know that I got there with this piece. I didn't. I think that the ending, the last 2,000 words, is all about that. I'm hopeful that the future can continue the dialogue.
So was there ever a question of OES itself not continuing? You know, obviously they dropped out of the news in the years afterward,
sure,
after the lawsuits and things were settled and went to trial and dismissed. But was there ever a question about the ability of OES, Oregon Episcopal School itself, going on?
Well, I think, personally, I think that it's extremely dangerous for the institution, and that that absolutely, you know, is part of their response, because first of all, I mean, even just from a financial perspective, if lawsuits would have gone through, and you know, they could have bankrupted the school, and I think that it would just would have destroyed so much. I mean, I think that the choice that those families made to not pursue litigation and to be tremendously private about it and to grieve together sort of with each other and with the administration to whatever extent they could. I think that that was a powerful decision for the school, and it preserved the school. And as a parent who has seen the school in action with my kids, who are, you know, my kids are great, but they are a little, you know, they could really get lost in a different environment, and I just feel so grateful that they are able to be cared for in the way that they are cared for right now and seen by the administrators at the school. So the school, in my mind, you know, even though there is a big argument about cost and private versus public, and this gets into all kinds of other issues in our country, in our society, you know, even though that is the case, the school has been an incredible thing for so many people, and so many people over the last 30 years have memories of love about this school, which is the case obviously with any school, but very powerfully for you know, for me, I feel it powerfully around OES.
Let's circle back around to the starting point, which is the Mount Hood Climb Service Day. First of all, there's been no climb since that one,
no,
in 1986, right?
Right,
no actual climb. But the service day then pays honor to the memory of the people lost. But what kinds of activities go on? What do people do on Climb Service Day?
Right. Well, I think that my kids' experience was in kindergarten. They cleared invasive species out of a local park. In second grade, they went to the food bank, and they performed acts of service at the food bank, and it was very much a little tiny acts. They go to a retirement community and they sing for the retirement community, the choir. They volunteer in different capacities around the Portland community, whether that's with a food pantry or a hospital or small organizations of that kind. So I think that the service day itself, is pretty visible and significant in that all 1,000 students perform an act of service of some kind.
All right, it really does pay honor to the people lost that day. There were two teachers and seven students dead on Mount Hood in May of 1986 on that climb from Oregon Episcopal School. The story is told anew up to the present day by Paul Stutange, who's got kids at OES. He's also a teacher at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. His piece is called The House of Mourning, available now at Outside Magazine online and in print. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, take care.